From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line with today's host, Father John Trigilio. In North America, call toll-free 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985 or send an email to openline@ewtn.com.
A tremendous Monday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. Father Trigilio is in the house. So if you've got a question for Father, pick up the phone and give us a call. The number is 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you're outside the United States and Canada, we'd still love to hear from you. That number is 1-205-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the front of the line at 1-205-271-2985. You can always send us an email. That email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams, Michael McCall, producing the program. Your call screener is Matt Kubensky. And Charles Beery is handling our social media efforts today. So if you're watching us on YouTube or Facebook Live, you can type a question into the chat window, and it may find its way to us by the end of the program. And our host, as he is every single Monday, Father John Trigilio, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks, Jack. How are you doing?
Good. You're like a Yankee Doodle. You're the Father George C. Patton today, ready to address the troops. Got a question here from Brian in South Carolina. He says, "Dear Father, I don't know what to do when confronted by beggars. During Lent, I was stopped by one after I had stopped to pay a bill. I gave him $20 because I was feeling grateful for what I have and because it was Lent. He said that wasn't enough and wanted me to drive him to an ATM to draw out more money. He was bigger and younger than me, so I said no, rolled up my windows, and drove away. Last week, a beggar approached me while I was getting ready to load groceries into my car and asked for money for himself and his girlfriend, who he claimed was living with him in a car on the other side of the parking lot. I told him no and left quickly. I donate monthly to the local food bank and make contributions at the grocery store and the poor box at church. I go for confession and adoration and am supporting my daughter and her five children at home. Still, I feel convicted when I read Luke 6:30, where Jesus tells us to always give to those who ask. Is it a sin, mortal or venial, to refuse a beggar?"
No. because if you're already doing these things, you're supporting charitable institutions like, you know, every diocese in the United States has Catholic Charities, and they do a phenomenal job in helping the poor. Your local parish, when I was a pastor for 16 years, in Marysville and Duncannon, Pennsylvania, we had the St. Vincent de Paul Society that worked from the parish, and we contributed to that as a parish, and I contributed myself as well. That way, they vet what's going on. When you give cash to somebody that you don't know, they meet you on the street, or like they would come to the rectory, I never gave cash because when I was newly ordained, I did the first day. And guess what? 20 people showed up the next day throughout the day. The word gets out that, hey, he's an easy touch. But I did get the next day some gift certificates. I don't even know if they make them anymore at McDonald's, but there was a gas station nearby. I got some gift cards from there. And I would give somebody the gift card, which would be anywhere from $1 to $5, maybe the most 10. The St. Vincent de Paul Society would make a little lunch bag or something like that. But when they want cash, it's usually so that they can buy drugs or alcohol and other nefarious things. When I was in Hershey, Pennsylvania, all the Christian churches in town contributed to a fund that was kept by the Hershey Police Department, and we would send people there, and if they didn't have a rap sheet, then we could authorize disbursement up to anywhere from like $100 to maybe even $250, $250. Now, if it was parishioners, and I knew them, they were known to me or known to the people in the office, that's a different matter. And as a pastor, I help people with their utilities, their electric, their gas, and things like that, making their mortgage payment. But when it's a stranger, it's too easy to be taken advantage of. And, you know, you almost become codependent if they're going to use it then to drink or shoot up or whatever. So don't feel that you're doing anything wrong in being prudent. And if you're already supporting these things like this person said they are, your first obligation is to care for your own family. You would not be doing anything Christian or virtuous if you neglected your family or yourself to help someone in need. Now, it's different if you have a surplus. And again, if you have leftover money, you just don't give it out to anybody and everyone because the unscrupulous will abuse that.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still a couple of open phone lines for you at 833-288-3986. John writes in, how do dispensations work? How can a bishop free us from something we're morally obliged to do?
Well, he can only dispense from those things that canon law empowers him to dispense. And the church, remember Jesus gave the keys to St. Peter, whatever you declare bound on earth is bound in heaven. So those keys, the authority to bind and loose, were given to Peter and his successors, the popes, the bishops in union with him, share in that to a degree. They don't have the fullness of the authority that the Roman pontiff does, but certainly within their own diocese. For instance, if a Catholic marries someone who's not baptized, they need a dispensation from the local bishop. If they don't get it, it's not a valid marriage. If a priest wants to be dispensed from his vows, it has to come directly from the Pope, the Bishop of Rome. What a bishop cannot dispense from is, okay, you know, you go ahead and commit adultery. No, he's not allowed to do that. He doesn't have the power to do that. So canon law is, church law is very specific on holy days. If I had a couple that was on a cruise and they tried everything they possibly could to get to Mass on a Sunday, but the ship was out in the middle of the ocean, I gave them a dispensation as my parishioner. The bishop can give a dispensation to the whole diocese. We saw that during the pandemic. So it depends on the situation and the context, but bishops and popes cannot ever dispense from the natural law or for divine positive law, only from what we call ecclesiastical or canon law.
Gary wants to know, how do we know the Catholic Church is the original church founded by Jesus?
Because he says so. In Matthew's gospel, he says to Peter, thou art Peter, upon this rock I, meaning Jesus, will build my church. He uses the word church, ecclesia in the Greek, ecclesia in Latin. It makes it very clear he established, it's his church. It's rooted in the authority was given to Peter, and the popes, the bishops of Rome, have been called and they are considered successors of St. Peter. So there's been this unbroken chain of command from St. Peter all the way to Pope Francis. He's called the successor of St. Peter. So, you know, if you're doing a family tree of sorts, you would see Peter at the top. He was placed there by Christ, and therefore you can see that there's that continuity. And we see that the four marks of the church, one holy, Catholic, and apostolic, like St. Robert Bellarmine explains to us, are found in the Catholic Church. We also see that there's a unity of faith, the one doctrine. There's just one catechism for the whole church, one set of laws, and we have one set of seven sacraments. You don't have seven sacraments in the United States and nine or four in Europe. There's continuity.
Excuse me. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. It's a free telephone call anywhere in North America. 833-288-3986. And as I mentioned earlier, you can call us if you're outside of the United States and Canada. That number is 877-271-2985. And we'll even put you straight to the line of the line. How am I doing? To the front of the line. If you call us at 1-205-271-2985. And you can always send us an email. That email address again is openline@ewtn.com. That's openline, all one word, at ewtn.com. Straight ahead, we'll talk to Garrett in South Dakota, Mary in Dallas, Texas, Noah in the great state of Michigan, and we've got plenty of time for your calls as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. If you have a question, call 1-833-288-EWTN. That's 1-833-288-3986. Outside North America, call 1-205-271-2985. Or send us an email to openline@ewtn.com.
You know, you'd be hard-pressed to find a media platform where an EWTN is not present. One of those great platforms is Radio FM. If you have the Radio FM app, you can listen to EWTN Radio's live stream. Just open the app and search EWTN. 833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Grab one of these open phone lines at 833-288-3986. First up today is Mary in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Mary, thanks for holding. You're on with Father John.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
We're here.
Go right ahead.
My question is, my friend and I were talking about Holy Doors Sunday yesterday, and how many times can you walk through a holy door to get a plenary indulgence?
Okay, you can walk once a day, even though you could, you could physically go through there more than once, but the indulgence, you can only obtain theoretically one plenary indulgence a day. And no matter how many times you walk through there, because I know in the Middle Ages, you had a few people thinking that they could multiply grace. And remember, grace is not quantitative, it's qualitative. And so, you know, we don't want people to think, well, if they went to Mass five times in one day, was that better if they could than someone who only went once a day? Certainly, you know, it's edifying if you can go to Mass more than once, but it's not something that you can measure in that sense that, you know, it's something that's observable, you know, quantitatively. So yes, once a day would be the most you could go to receive the benefit of the plenary indulgence.
So it might be a good idea to kind of lay out the rest of that whole process, because just strolling through the door ain't going to get you an indulgence.
That's right. You have to be free from any attachment, either the venial sin, which is very difficult. But if you're not, it can default, as long as you're in the state of grace, to a partial indulgence, which is still good. You have to say, on Our Father, Hail Mary, glory be for the intentions of the Holy Father. You have to receive Holy Communion that day, and you have to have gone to confession 20 days before or after the day you walk through the door. And then that would satisfy with the requisite for the plenary indulgence.
All right, Mary, do you feel like a Holy Door scholar now?
I do, but I do have one more question.
Sure.
Once it's a holy door, is it a holy door forever? Because I did get on the internet last night and was looking up. There's a lot of holy doors in the U.S.
Yes. The bishop can establish a holy door for the holy year. Usually it's at the cathedral and at the Vatican, at St. Peter's. They have two huge bronze doors, which they typically only open and close every 25 or 50 years for the holy year. And yet, if you were to go through that door outside the holy year, there is no particular indulgence. It's only applicable during the holy year. And like I said, it used to be every 50 years. I think it was Pius the 12th that reduced it every 25. And then you had some special occasions, like in 1988, the year I was ordained, it was declared the Marian year. Pope Benedict declared a year for priests. So the Pope can add some extra ones in there. But you will find these, but the pastor, unfortunately, the pastor can't do it himself. When I was a pastor, I couldn't say, oh, we got a holy door here in Perry County. It doesn't work that way.
God bless you, Mary. We appreciate the call today. Next up is Noah in the great state of Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. Noah, you're on with Father John Trujillo.
Hello?
Hi, Noah. Yes. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so I had a question. So I'm a Lutheran convert. I'm going to go through RCIA this academic year. And as I'm praying the rosary more and I'm trying to learn the prayers, I came across, I'm going to memorize it at some point. It's the Hail Holy Queen prayer. And in that it says, Mary, you are our life, our sweetness, and our hope. And I'm hard set on becoming Catholic, so this isn't an issue, but I just like to understand. Jesus says he is the way, the truth, and the life. So I'm just trying to understand, you know, there is the whole Protestant argument, oh, you worship Mary. Well, I like to clarify and have arguments against this, you know, because we do say this in the rosary. I just like to understand why it's phrased this way and why it doesn't take away from Jesus.
Yes. No, I'm glad you called, and I'm very happy that you're coming into full communion with the church, and be praying for you. And I think it's wonderful. Anything we ascribe to Mary is because of her relationship to Jesus. Even like the title Queen of Heaven and Earth, she's queen only because her son is the king. Any references we give to her, any honors are not due to her alone, is because of her relationship to Jesus, because Jesus is the Savior. He is the Redeemer, but she's the mother of the Savior. She's the mother Redeemer. It doesn't put her above Jesus, doesn't even make her equal to Jesus, but because she is the mother of Jesus, and remember, Jesus is true God and true man in his divinity, in his divine nature. He always existed from all eternity as the second person of the Trinity. But in his humanity, in his human nature, he had a beginning in time. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. So the incarnation, when Mary was told by the angel Gabriel she was going to conceive and bear a son, that's the moment that Jesus took flesh, and his human nature was created when he was conceived in the womb of his mother. So the honors, the phrases we ascribe to her are because of her relationship. Many times they're metaphorical, they're allegorical, but in no way do they draw away. So what we're not allowed, and you rightly point out, we're not allowed to worship Mary because that'd be a violation of the first commandment. However, in the fourth commandment, we're obligated to honor our father and mother. And if Jesus, and we certainly believe this, is truly our brother, well, guess what? Your brother, your sister, you share the mother. And so Jesus' mother, if we're spiritual brothers and sisters of Jesus, then we'll be spiritual children of Mary. Again, it doesn't in any way, shape, or form dilute or make Mary's relationship equal, but it's by extension.
833-288-EWTN. That's our toll-free number. Open phone lines available right now at 833-288-3986. Jennifer is in the great state of New York, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Jennifer, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Hello?
Hi, Jennifer. Go right ahead.
All right. So here's my question. In the 5th century, historically, Saint Peter was selected, you know, as one of the apostles and the founder of our Catholic Church. And he was married. And then the traditions changed, and priests were not allowed to get married. anymore. Why can there not be changes within the present Catholic Church? Why couldn't that be part of a change, a renewal, to allow priests to marry? Especially
okay, well, that's
now,
a fair question. First of all, Peter was chosen by Jesus to be the head of the church, and that's in the first century. As you point out, the Council of Elvira around 309, 306 AD made celibacy normative for the Latin or Western Church. It became mandatory in the 11th century by Pope Gregory. However, in the Eastern Catholic Church, celibacy was never made mandatory. It was optional. So you did have married clergy. You had married priests in the Eastern Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church. However, the bishops were always celibate. So if a man was married before his ordination, then in the Eastern Church, you have married deacons, you have married priests, but no married bishops. It's a discipline. So theoretically, the Pope could dispense it from the Latin Church, but we've been doing it since, like you said, the fourth century, since 309 AD, and you know, it's been working. I know sometimes people say, well, wouldn't you get more people, more priests, if you allowed them to marry? Well, I'm close friends with a number of Protestant ministers, and they told me very clearly, you know, they have married clergy, they have women ministers, and in the beginning, you know, it looked like, oh, this is going to be solve all our problems. Well, guess what? They're having a vocation crisis as well. So it's not a panacea. And because the Catholic priests in the Western Church, our rectories, our parishes are set up in such a way, our salary is, we couldn't support a wife and children, and the rectory would not be adequate for that. You wouldn't be able to have more than one priest in the rectory. So parishes that had a couple priests, they'd have to figure out something else. And as a priest in the Latin Church, in Latin Rite, I can devote 100% of my time to my parish. I can get up at 3 a.m. To go to the hospital. If I got a wife or a child who's ill, I have to say, they come first, and yet, you know, I'm ordained. I know the married priests in the Byzantine and Eastern Catholic Church are able to do this, but it's difficult. And so I think in the Latin Rite, which most people here in the United States are familiar with, realize that. But in the Eastern Church, you know, it has always been an option, at least for the diaconate and for the priesthood, not for the bishops.
Does that help a little bit, Jennifer?
It did, but yet there is a renewal, and I have friends who are not Catholic and who respect me that I'm Catholic, and they still believe that maybe there would be more, you know, an increase, especially with the millennials or the Generation X.
Would they become Catholic if we let priests get married?
Is that directed to me?
Well, I was asking Jennifer, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I teach at a seminary, and I can tell you that the guys realize, you know, and they're in the seminary anywhere from 4 to 8 or 12 years, and it's a long time to discern. So, you know, they don't take celibacy. The vow of celibacy does not happen until you're a deacon, which is 1 year before your priesthood. So that's a long, dating engagement process there.
Yeah, it's EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Got some open phone lines for you at 833-288-EWTN. Give us a call at 833-288-3986. Next stop is Harrisburg, PA. Mike is in the Commonwealth today, listening on Holy Family Radio. Mike, you're on with Father Trigilio.
Yeah, hi, Father. I'm in the Harrisburg area. The Seven Stars of the Blessed Virgin Mary, the number one prophecy of Simeon, is that some kind of something that she foretold? That was she foreseen or something like that? And I have one more question after that.
Well, Simeon prophesied to her that a sword would pierce her heart, and so that was the prophecy that was revealed to her, and what she understood that to be, we don't know, but I don't, you know, personally think she had any precise concept other than, you know, imagine, just to give you an analogy, you're at your child's baptism, and some old person comes up and says, this child of yours is going to be the rise and downfall of many, and a sword will pierce your heart. You are never going to forget that, but you're never going to understand until it happens. And I think Mary, being, you know, the human that she was, but also a real mother, was constantly thinking, what does this mean? When's it going to take place? And then when she sees Jesus, her only son, die on the cross on Good Friday, and the Longinus, the Roman soldier, thrust the spear into his sacred heart, I think that's when she realized the prophecy was fulfilled. But up until that point, you know, I don't think she had any precise idea of how that was going to take place and when. Nevertheless, that's the point of a prophecy, is not that you know it and understand it with all this detail. Only God would do that.
And you had a follow-up, Mike?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Father, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, can you say that for people that are like my family members or friends that already passed away, or is that just for people on their deathbed, or how does that work? Can you say it to you myself or anybody?
You can offer for anyone, because any prayer is good for yourself, but also for a living person, and you can pray, offer it for any soul in purgatory. So yes, like the rosary, the Divine Mercy Chaplet is applicable to not just yourself, but to anyone. The only people it would not have any benefit to is someone, if God forbid, they're in hell. But since we don't know, we give everyone the benefit of the doubt, at least thinking that they're, at least if they're dead, that they may be in purgatory. So I would not exclude anyone from those prayers.
God bless you, Mike. We appreciate that call today. That opens up a phone line for you, along with five others. Wide open lines for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Lee would like to know how he can talk to his 20-year-old fallen away son about coming back to the faith.
Oh, well, do so with charity and love. Pray before and after. The best thing you could do is give good example. And as I've been telling a lot of parents of grown sons and daughters who've not stopped practicing the faith, or lukewarm, or at least tepid, get some book like Catholicism for Dummies, and don't give it to them in full view, because then they'll just throw it away or hide it. When they're not looking, leave it somewhere where they'll find it. You know, put it somewhere in the family reading room, if you know what I mean. If they stumble across it and no one's looking, they will maybe perhaps flip through it, and that might just be what they need. But the most important thing is, remember Saint Monica, the mother of Saint Augustine, she prayed 30 years for her son, and he converted, and then he, you know, became Saint Augustine. He became the Bishop of Hippo, and he became a saint. So don't get discouraged, but you're not going to get your son or daughter back by nagging them. Nevertheless, you don't want to give up on them either. So pray every day, make some little mortifications for them, and keep inviting them. Just, you know, say, hey, you know, how about we go to Mass, and then we'll all go out to breakfast. You know, all they can do is say no. Certainly you want to start by inviting them to Mass on Christmas and Easter, reminding them, of course, you know, that they need to go to confession if they want to go to communion. But some people don't invite anymore. Some people try to argue them. That's not going to work either. And remember what Jesus said, a prophet is not without honor except where in his own house. So you have to persevere. But you have to do it with kindness and charity.
Matt would like to know, sometimes I feel like God has set us up to sin. We're predisposed to sin, but God set us up that way. Why would he make us like that?
Well, God did not. He created Adam and Eve in the state of innocence. Adam and Eve fully, deliberately, consciously committed the sin that they did, original sin, and concupiscence, which is our proclivity, our tendency to sin, is a consequence of that. In the same way, if you were exposed to some kind of gamma radiation, it might alter your genetic structure to an extent that you could then pass that on to your children. There are many things that we inherit biologically from our parents, our grandparents, and great grandparents that they were maybe not aware of. But in terms of sin, original sin is something we inherit. Actual sin is something that we do. But any sin is going to be repugnant in the eyes of God. That's why we want to certainly have people baptized, and we want to be in the state of grace. So God did not make us wounded or broken. We became that way, and yet he didn't give up on us. So grace, as St. Thomas Aquinas said, gratia non tollit, sed perficit naturam. Grace doesn't destroy nature, it perfects it. It heals it. Martin Luther described original sin as corrupting human nature. The Council of Trent said, no, it wounded us, and God's grace heals us.
Mike wants to know, if you don't complete your penance after confession, does that nullify your absolution?
It would only nullify it if you intended to do it all along. If the priest said for your penance, say five Hail Marys, and you think to yourself, no, I'm not going to do that, that's obstinacy. But if you forget or you're impeded from doing it, your sorrow is what's important, your firm purpose of amendment. And part of that firm purpose of amendment is that you're willing, or at least going to try, to fulfill your penance. So only if someone obstinately and consciously, deliberately refuses to do. But I know some people, they literally forget. It's happened to me a few times. I mean, I went in there and I forgot what the priest said. Sometimes you get some of these priests that are a little out there, you know what I mean, on the fringe. One told me to get an ice cream cone. And I'm thinking, oh, is it two scoop or is it gelato? I got confused. But, if you forget your penance, don't worry about it. But certainly mention next time you're in confession, not that you've got this, it's not like you got to amend your income tax return like with the IRS, but to alleviate your conscience, you may just want to mention that.
Next up is Ray. He is in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Ray, you are on with Father John Trigilio.
Hi, Father John. How you doing today?
Marvelous.
Okay, I got a good one for you, okay? And I got a buddy of mine listening to this because I'm calling in for him because he's too scared to ask you. And he knows, but we've been buddies our whole life. All right, we're both of us in our 70 years of age and more, okay? Well, anyway, he's going to kill me. But anyway, he told me, he says he was at a party. He says this girl he knew back in high school, he's married and everything. And he gave her a really good kiss, and he says, and he felt good and everything like that. He says, but he feels like he committed a mortal sin. And he says, if he goes, he's gone to confession, and he says, he's told the priest, he says, I've had problems, and everything, but he won't outline if he actually did this. But he feels in his heart that it was a mortal sin. He's not going to do it again. Is he forgiven?
Well, let's put it in context, okay? If it was just an innocent kiss on the cheek, like us Italians we do, that's nothing wrong with that. But if a man kisses a woman, especially if it's not his wife, and it's a romantic kiss, okay, a long prolonged kiss on the lips, certainly. If it's much more involved with that, that is inappropriate. But a kiss on the hand is quite continental, as they say, a kiss on the cheek. So it's the intent and the context, too. certainly I as a priest have to be conscious if, you know, a female parishioner or, you know, I'm at the seminary, one of the secretaries, I'm going to be very careful not to kiss them on the lips, at least not too romantically. I'm going to purposely keep it on the cheek and just in and out, okay? Keep it very brief. But you see an old girlfriend, or if a woman sees an old boyfriend, and, you know, it's not a closed mouth kiss, you're getting into dangerous territory. The longer it is, that's even that becomes a problem there. But the kiss itself, it has to be put in context. And like I said, you have to also take into consideration the person's state. Let's say this was an old girlfriend, but now your old girlfriend's a nun. Ooh, don't be kissing her, okay?
What about this this business of sort of stopping short of saying exactly what you did in the confessional?
Well, you know, if you're ever confused, or you're nervous, anxious that maybe it was a sin, tell the priest. Okay, you know, he's there to help. But I would not avoid communion unless you had the idea that what you did was grave matter, okay? Because you need grave matter, full consent of the will, and sufficient knowledge. All three are requisite for mortal sin. So if this something that happened, and then you on reflection say, maybe that wasn't the most prudent, it's most likely not a mortal sin. At least you don't have the full culpability of it. But if you're ever in doubt, mention the priest. We just don't want people to become scrupulous and think, oh my gosh, was it? I don't know. Could it be? I don't know. That could be torture too for you.
Ketabim called in, and he is in Maryland, was not able to hold on, but he wants to know if it's okay to date someone who never wants anything to do with Catholicism. She won't go in a Catholic church and would refuse to raise kids Catholic. If I date her, do I have to leave the church?
Well, you don't have to leave her for dating her, but I would say this: if there's any possibility of you getting married, you're the one who's going to have to make the promise to raise them in the Catholic faith. We used to in the old days, before I was born, which is going back, you know, 62 years ago. In the old days, we asked the non-Catholic to sign a document promising they'd raise the children. We realized that wasn't fair or just. But the Catholic now, when the Catholic marries a non-Catholic, the Catholic party is asked to make a promise, a solemn oath. They will do everything in their power to raise the children in the Catholic faith. So the non-Catholic is not under any pressure or obligation to convert, but the Catholic must make sure that he or she goes to church on Sundays and holy days, and he or she has to make sure that the children are baptized, receive communion, confirmation, and go to Mass. So it may not be something that you have, that there's going to be a reasonable hope of this working out. But again, if there's a possibility that you might convince this woman to embrace the faith, maybe she will by seeing what a good person you are and how your faith helps. But if it's not either or, if you have to choose, you have to choose for God. Your faith must come first. Hopefully, and I had a lot of relatives, aunts and uncles and cousins who married people outside the faith. And guess what? A good portion of them became Catholic because the Catholic party, persevered and gave good example.
Next stop for us is the great state of Connecticut. Frank is listening on the Amazon Echo today. Frank, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Yeah, hi, Father. I'd like to know, usually when I go to the cemetery, I carry holy water with me, and I will bless my wife's grave if the church allows that. And then there are people that want to bless their grave, so I give them the holy water. Does the church allow that?
Yes, that would not be disallowed. I mean, certainly that's a good thing to do, because that's the purpose of a sacramental like holy water. Now, it's true, the grave, if it's already blessed, is blessed. So, it's not redundant, But it's just like when you go to the church and you bless yourself with holy water, you've done this more than once, hopefully. Every time you go into a Catholic church, you should bless yourself on the way in and on the way out. So yes, by all means, you can sprinkle holy water at the cemetery. You can sprinkle it at home. I've seen people sprinkle it at work. As long as you do it respectfully, reverently, there's no problem.
Does that help, Frank?
Can you allow to give it to other people that are nearby that want to bless their graves?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, yes, you may. Yes.
833-288-EWTN is our toll-free number. Still time for your calls at 833-288-3986. You know, another great podcast at EWTN's Podcast Central is the Cardinal Newman Society podcast with Kevin Murphy. It acquaints listeners with the beauty of a faithful Catholic education and what is not. You can hear the Cardinal Newman Society podcast and other faith-filled podcasts from our friends and affiliates around the world, all in one place, EWTN's Podcast Central. They're all free at EWTN.com/radio, and then just click on Podcast Central today. 833-288-EWTN, that's our toll-free number. Here is a rubber meets the road question for you, Father. Jane wants to know, how on earth can both the church and Mary be our mother?
Okay, well, just like we talk about, the motherland, okay? Whenever I go to Italy, I say, oh, I'm back in the motherland. It's analogous, okay? Mary is our spiritual mother. The church is our spiritual mother. They're not exclusive. They don't push one out of the way. In the same way, I can say my brother Mark is my brother because biologically we had the same parents, but I also have brother priests, and we have no biological connection, but sacramentally we're both priests, ordained and received holy orders. We're brothers and sisters in Christ. We could even see that your brethren would include people of the same nationality or fellow Americans, as we'll be celebrating on 4th of July. So it's analogous, okay? So it's not mutually exclusive. It's always the context which is important to keep in mind here.
Russ is in the great state of Michigan listening on Holy Family Radio. Russ, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Hi. Question for you. I've been doing a Marian devotion. So the first Saturday in June, my wife and I were planning on going to Mass. Drove a half an hour to get there. And turns out that there was no Mass due to ordination that day. Does that, even though that there was no Mass, does that still count towards my Marian devotion?
I would say you made a good attempt, so there, you have nothing to fear. It's not like a bank statement where either you made the deposit or you did not. If you in good faith made the attempt to do that, because many times people will drive for hours. I had a friend of mine that once, was camping, and they made every good effort to go to Mass on Sunday. They were away for the whole weekend, and wherever church they ended up at was closed. I mean, it was shut down, and they thought it was open. Back then, they didn't have cell phones, and you could go to masstimes.org to find out. So they were not guilty of the sin of missing Mass because they made an effort to do so. And then likewise with our Marian devotion, it's not that legalistic, and yet you don't want to be too casual either. So as long as you intended to do it, you made an effort, you're in good stead.
We head next to the great state of Colorado. Sheila is listening on the EWTN app. Sheila, you're on with Father Trujillo.
Hi, thank you. I just was hoping Father could go more deeply into indulgences, what they mean and what they do for us.
Okay, I'd be happy to. An indulgence is the remission of temporal punishment due to sin. So when we commit a sin and we go to confession, our sins are forgiven as long as we're genuine in our sorrow, our contrition, and we've confessed all known mortal sins since our last confession, and we have a firm purpose of amendment, and we do the satisfaction for that. There's still an injustice that still exists because sin just doesn't affect me, myself. It affects my relationship with God and my relationship with the church. And just like when I was a kid and I didn't listen to my dad and he said, don't roughhouse in the living room. Well, me and my brother did. We were jumping on the couch and, you know, we bounced off the couch and I landed on the cabinet and broke one of my mother humbles. Okay. Well, guess what? Not only did I have to tell mommy that I did it, but my father said, you're going to have to save up your allowance and help pay for a new Hummel there, which they weren't cheap then and they're not cheap now. Indulgence is the way in which the church applies the infinite works of Christ, the superabundant works of Our Lady and all the saints, and in an individual way apply them so that, for instance, a person who's dying, there's a potential for the plenary indulgence, the final apostolic pardon, which that's why when people are getting ready to pass away, it's so important for people to call the priest and not, you know, when there's only 15 minutes left, call the priest a few days, a week or so, even a month before the person, hopefully you get them there beforehand, because the plenary indulgence is at least possible. And that would, if it came to pass, that would mean that when the person dies, they could go to heaven that day. The plenary indulgence is full remission of all temporal punishment due to sin. Now, being completely detached even from venial sin is very difficult. That's why we say that if it's not plenary, it could at least be partial, which is still better than no remission of that temporal punishment. So again, it's not quantitative, it's qualitative. We don't want people to, you know, get this idea that, well, it's 300 days shaved off your sentence in purgatory, but it's a way of personalizing what Jesus and all the saints and the Blessed Mother have done, and all their the crosses that they bore, the sufferings they endured, and applying to me in a particular way. And it's a beautiful affirmation of us, the church, as the mystical body of Christ.
I wouldn't have taken you for a Hummel assassin.
Well, I thought they were Goebbels myself, but.
Oh, goodness. Thanks so much. Sheila, does that clear it up for you?
Yeah, that really helps. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. We appreciate the phone call today. Jack wants to know what the difference is between homosexual orientations and actions.
Okay, inclination is a proclivity, a desire, an affection, an attraction to the same sex. That's why it's called homosexual. It's either orientation or inclination. Homosexual activity, however, is when it's actual deeds, acts, okay? When people do things, when they have sex with someone of the same sex, that's homosexual activity. The fact that they're attracted to the same sex. Now, they're still trying to figure out, you know, is this something that's biological? Is something learned? What's important here for it to be sinful? Because remember, the catechism says the orientation is disordered. The sinfulness is in the willing, deliberate, conscious committing of the acts. The inclination itself, though, is considered disordered, which means it's not what God had originally intended. In the same way, if somebody has an inclination to, you know, do something that they, you know, I had a friend of mine who had a problem with kleptomania. You know, they always were taking things. Well, that inclination, that proclivity to do those things, you know, they may not be in complete control, but you are in control of what you do, all right? So what you're attracted to, you may not have complete control over, but you do control how you respond to that, and that's the distinction the catechism and the moral theology make.
And really quickly, Ava wants to know, what's meant in the Bible when it says to fear the Lord?
Fear the Lord is to respect him, like I respected my dad. We had a proper fear of him, that we were terrified of him, but we did not want to lose his respect. And so fear the Lord means that you're not afraid of punishment. You respect him enough that you don't want to disappoint him.
Father, would you leave us with a blessing?
Absolutely. Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
Amen. On behalf of our host, Father John Trigilio, our producer, Michael McCall, call screener Matt Kubensky, and our social media maven, Mr. Charles Beery, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in. Back at it tomorrow with Father Wade. Until then, God bless.